This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
It's been a fun week. All week I've been playing with my drone.
And causing damage.
That is another issue. I did crash my drone this week. This week we're going to talk about the man who developed the first personal computer.
Uh-huh.
As you might expect, the first personal computer company did go bankrupt.
Of course.
And he didn't make much money out of it.
But it probably cost a lot of money, though.
Actually, the first one was only $750.
Wow.
We'll get into that. And okay. It actually preceded the Intel's large-scale integrated central processing
unit.
This
should be a good story.
Oh, yeah, it is an interesting story. And, of course, it was a huge, huge mailbag.
Huge.
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Actually, it's two mailbags.
Is it?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
See?
You've been working out because you picked them both up at the same time.
I've been pumping iron because the mail's getting a little bit. Well, you know, I need something, you know, because you never know what's going to happen when I fly my drone around.
I may have to have
some kind of confrontation somehow where, you know, I'm trying to avoid that.
You have a very vivid imagination.
Yeah, I just sneak over to my neighbor's yard to get my drone pieces. I picked up all the pieces. Fortunately, he didn't see me tiptoeing over there to his yard getting all my pieces. But now the drone.
What time of day was this?
It was dusk. You know, I like to fly the drone at night to see the drone sunset. I like to see sunset from drone.
Oh, that's
from drone
a great
altitude.
Idea.
So it was at dusk. You know, so here I'm tiptoeing around his yard. It's just getting dark. We got an email from Alice in Wonderland. Now, Alice is one of our, you know, regular listeners. I don't know how she hears the show down there in Wonderland, probably. She's probably getting the podcast. The podcast over the net, yeah. You just run probably a fiber optic down to Wonderland, I would think.
Where is Wonderland?
Well, it's underground. I don't know exactly where it is, but you go through some kind of cave and then fall down a hole.
Oh, okay.
As you remember. She remembers she fell down the hole and
That's
she met
right.
all these people down there. So they probably just ran a fiber optic down that hole. And you know, I'm really thinking we're ready for like a revised Alice in Wonderland
show. I think you probably should just read her letter now.
Okay. Dear Dr. Schertz, I'm looking for a new job. You know, Wonderland may not be the
unemployment rate down there is crazy
That's
bad.
That's right. Ever since I put my resume on Dice and Monster, I'm getting 150-plus emails daily. Mm-hmm. And this one place, Duke Careers, keeps sending email after email, and I can't stop it. They're clogging up my mail folder. I don't know what to do. You know, I'm almost ready to give up looking for a job with all this distraction. What do you think I should do? Are there any better options than putting your resume on these large job boards? Well, thanks for a great program, Alice. Listening all the way in Wonderland.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if the same company is sending you something, you can blacklist their domain, so you can go into your email provider and you can list domain names that you want to blacklist. And if they're not changing their domain name with every email, that will in fact work. Even if the email text changes, if it comes from the same domain, it would be blocked. I would recommend you do that. But I'll tell you, I think these job sites are really set up to be to the advantage of the employer and of the employment agencies, not necessarily the advantage of the individual. I love the technique. What color is the techniques outlined by Dick Bowles in What Color Is Your Parachute?
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it's basically the anti-resume technique. It's where you do information surveys, you join organizations, you sort of get to know people in the area, and he has a whole technique for doing it. And was actually based on John Crystal's methods for intelligence gathering. John Crystal was was Dick Bowles' mentor, and John used to live in McLean, Virginia. I took a class from John Crystal many years ago, and he was an intelligence agent in Germany, and he'd go out and he would gather information. And so he used information gathering techniques from his war days to develop a technique for looking for a job. Because most jobs that are really out there tend to be filled before they're before the advertisements hit the street, and they're normally filled with people who you know or contacts, and so you've got to get a different method of communicating. So that is a great book. I recommend it to all of my students, What Color's Your Parachute by Dick Bowles. Also, if you can also pick up a lot of part-time work. You know, now, you know, in this new economy, like with guru.com, you can actually put your skill set on there. You can bid on projects. And so you might find a project that you're interested in, which would be a way to get some experience in a different area and bid on it, even if it's a loss leader. Like for instance, when we were developing, we were developing our online platform. As there was some PHP programming. We basically went onto guru.com and we got a couple of guys bidding on it. We got some great programmers actually. They were actually in Russia and some of these Eastern Bloc countries, and we had some great programming from these guys, and it was good experience for them. So this could be an opportunity for you. And it's just not programming jobs on these sites like guru.com. You can bid on many other things. So that's just another way to get connected with the job market. But I would do something non-conventional instead of the conventional way of just putting your resume up on these sites. Great email. Thank you, Alice, all the way from Wonderland. We got an email from Alan in Herndon. Dear Tech Talk, what is browser cache? How do I clear it? Why do I even want it?
Ooh.
It doesn't seem to bother me. Love the show, Alan. I guess people can talk about browser cache with
him. Can I ask browser cache at the store?
Yeah. No,
you can't do that.
No, browser cache does not work at the store. No, even if it's an all cash store, they typically don't take browser cache. But here's what cache is. Cache is actually C-A-S-H-E. It has an E on it. So it's actually temporary storage. So you store something locally. So for instance, like in your kitchen, you've got a pantry, we'll say, with canned goods in it. Well, that's like a canned good cache. Mm-hmm. Because if every time you want a can of soup, you had to run to the grocery store and buy that one can of soup, I mean, that'd be a pain in the neck.
Yeah.
It's much better to go and, you know, and store it locally in some sort of soup cache. And so having local storage as a way to eliminate trips is where the word cache came from, C-A-S-H-E. And it's been used not just in technical terms, but just in general for a long time. Now, what the browser does, of course, the browser, it doesn't go to the store. It goes to a website, and it grabs a web page and pictures. Well, if you're going back to the same website over and over again and you're grabbing the same pictures, the browser says, hey, wait, why am I downloading that same stinking picture again? Why don't I just keep it locally and load it from my local memory or my local cache? So your browser will store web parts in the local cache, and you can tell your browser how much of your hard drive you're willing to allocate to cache. And when the cache fills up, it'll just erase the old stuff to store new stuff. And that allows you to let a web page load quickly. Now, here's where you can encounter a problem. Suppose that you're downloading a page and something happens and one of the web parts is corrupted when it's downloaded, or you turn off your computer and it's only partially downloaded. Then when you go to that page again, it's going to load that corrupted web part into your browser, and then the page isn't going to load. So that's why they say if you can't get the page to load, you know, clear your cache so you get any corrupted parts out of there. Or you may have another problem. Suppose that you're looking at a blog every day. So you go to the blog and you say, well, they haven't updated this blog since the last time I looked at it. Well, it could be you're pulling out the old copy of the blog from your cache, and all the updates aren't there.
Mm-hmm.
So when you bring that web page up, you can hit the refresh button, and you can force your browser to load a new version of it. And or sometimes you just want to clear your cache if you don't like to carry around all that extra stuff around. I periodically will clear my cache if I ever have, like when I'm developing a web page and I want to see the latest version, I want to make certain I don't have an old one. I will clear my cache. And it's going to be in Internet Explorer. You can just click down Tools, and then there's a little gear icon in the upper right-hand corner. Then there's an Internet Options menu, and then you, under Browsing History, you can click the Delete button, and then you can delete what they call temporary Internet files. And temporary Internet files are what they call cache. So you can delete them. Now, website owners, though, like if you have a blog, you should always make certain that the latest page is not taken out of cache. And there's actually a meta tag that you can put in. It's an expires meta tag. And you put down, and you can tell it how often to reload it. And you can have the page expire after so long. And so if you put that the expire time is zero, which means it's already expired, it will always load new content and not take it out of cache. So if you got that problem I said with the blog, it means the guy that set up the blogging page didn't set it up correctly and didn't have that expire meta tag in there. But that was a good question. We got an email from Doug in Richmond. Dear Tech Talk, what's the best option for backing up my laptop? I've heard of many things discussed. What's the cheapest option? Yep. So Doug, you know, going after the cheapest option. Well, Doug, I tend to use cloud backup for my laptop. It's easy to maintain when I'm traveling. My files are always backed up as I create them. Now, the one thing I don't like about it, sometimes they're backed up too fast, so I'm working on a file, and then I try to save it, and it says you can't save it because it's in use by something else. So sometimes I'm working on the Tech Talk podcast, and I'll get in the middle of it, and I can't save it because my cloud backup system is backing up the file that I'm still working on. So that irritates me. So what I'll put my cloud backup on pause so it's not backing up the files as I'm using them, and that's... That's the one small annoyance. I use Carbon, which I like. There are other ones. I like Carbon. It's $59 a year. But there are cheaper options. I just bought an external hard drive, a 1 terabyte external hard drive. It's got USB 3.0, $62. $62.
That's, yeah.
I mean, that's just 1 terabyte. And it's, you don't even need an extra power supply. It's powered through the USB. So you just plug in the USB. You got 1 terabyte of storage.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking $62 for 1 terabyte of storage compared to $59 a year for Carbonite.
Yeah.
Maybe you could just back up to that hard drive, which wouldn't be my particular one is branded Toshiba. I didn't really crack it open. I don't know that Toshiba necessarily makes hard drives. They might have another hard drive manufacturer in there, and they've just branded it. But that is actually a pretty good option. Now, the one downside, if you carry your external hard drive with you in your laptop case, and the laptop gets stolen, then your backup's stolen. So you still have the security problem that you'd have. And you could back up at home. You could get a file server which would attach to your router, and they make those. But these are more expensive. And if you really want to get super duper secure, you could get one that has two hard drives in it, and they're duplexed. And you can get a duplex file server for a couple $100s. We're walking up in the money, and then each hard drive might be another $100. So you're talking $300 or $400 to get a very, very secure backup system in your own home that would give you some redundancy. That's what the duplex is. You write the data to two drives at the same time. So even if one drive goes out, the other drive has it. And once you've got a duplex system, you would be able to, if you'd want, delete it from your laptop because the duplex system is going to be reliable enough.
Mm-hmm.
But with that single hard drive that I've got, that's one copy. Your laptop's got another copy. You can't delete it from your laptop, say if you've got pictures, because now it's only on one drive again. So that's the mistake people frequently make with their pictures. They copy them to the external hard drive, and then they delete them on the laptop thinking they're backed up. But actually, they still only
have one
copy.
On one place.
Yeah, so
if the external drive goes up, then you've got a problem.
You got a problem. So I guess you could get two external drives, but this is why people go to this whole duplex deal.
Mm-hmm.
So sorry, I get a little overboard with my sidebars.
Well, that's okay, but because I have another sidebar. This past week, I don't know how I saw this, but I was going to ask you about this thing that I saw. It's called the WD My Cloud. It's like a personal cloud tower that you can have at home. Mm-hmm. Have you seen this thing?
It's a Western Digital. That WD's Western Digital. Uh-huh. Yeah, they're one of the. They call it My Cloud. Uh-huh. It's actually just a file server.
Okay.
But because people think cloud is cool,
they just decide.
I mean, it's just a file server plugged into your router.
Uh-huh.
But because you know you're storing it somewhere, it must be the cloud.
But it's not. You're still storing it.
They call it My Cloud, which means it's really not on the cloud. It's in my house.
Well, the cloud is a box somewhere anyway. You just can't see the box if you're using like...
Okay, this is where the idea of cloud came from. You have multiple servers, and you've got some kind of load management. So like if one server becomes overloaded, the traffic's diverted to another server, and there's load balancing between them. Mm-hmm. So you actually don't know where your stuff is stored because of the load balancing, but you really don't care. As long as it's there. So that's what the cloud was all about. Mm-hmm. It's not a specific device. It's a cluster of devices that are interconnected over the Internet. Now, a single device in your house doesn't exactly qualify as a cloud. So my cloud is just... a marketing deal. It's a fancy name. So if you're going to use My Cloud, and if it's only one drive in it, it's mm-hmm. still you still don't have redundancy. So I would get the upgraded Western Digital unit. I mean, they're a whole series
of I would get three to four terabytes.
But I would get one that has at least two drives in it,
uh-huh.
and that's the lowest level of redundancy. And then you save to both drives at the same time. That's called duplexed. And then mm-hmm. and then you could then really use that as your backup and delete it and delete your pictures from your laptop. But yeah, everything is cloud these days. It's the new N-word. It's the new buzzword. Well,
yeah.
My drone flies in the clouds too, Jim. So I'm connected to clouds multiple ways.
You were the world's biggest kid.
Okay, we got an
Which is fine.
I love it.
I think it's great. We had a blast with this thing last week.
I actually, you know, I'm thinking I may have to upgrade my drone. I'm already looking at bigger drones.
Oh, good grief.
Looking at bigger drones. But if I get bigger drones, then I may have some serious, you know, FAA issues if they can start staying up a long time and flying everywhere.
I have an idea which we can talk about off the air.
Okay. We got an email from Susan. Dear Doc and Jim, I have a 64-gigabyte flash drive and have stored all my pictures on it.
Mm-hmm.
It's very convenient, but is it reliable? Love the show. Sue from Reston. Well, this whole reliability issue, Sue. I mean, these 64-gigabyte drives are great. I just got a 64-gigabyte drive, USB 3.0. It's only $45. And you can just save stuff on it. But I'm telling you, it's really a file transfer drive. It's a file transfer drive. I've just seen too many thumb drives that become corrupted or damaged. And you cannot use it as real backup. Now, I have to admit, I've had some of my thumb drives for years. I've never had a problem.
Yeah.
But I've heard horror stories. People,
yeah.
you know, static electricity and things can damage them. And so I would not use it for an actual backup. You've got a 64 gigabyte thumb drive that probably costs you $45. I could get a 1 terabyte drive for $62.
Right.
That's USB.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be far more reliable than the thumb drive.
And you know what else is really good to do with thumb drives?
What?
Lose them.
Yeah.
Because they're so small.
It's really easy to lose them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now my trick is I get a thumb drive that's got a little hole in it. Put
yeah.
it on the keychain.
Yeah, right.
Then you've got to lose your keys.
I have a bag in my other bag of all of my various and sundry thumb drives and cables and junk like that, so it's less
yeah.
of a chance, but it's
See, technology was supposed to make our life easy.
It has.
Now you've got to carry a whole big bag with you just to keep all your technology stuff in there. I got two bags, because now I'm carrying my drone around with me, you know,
that to school with you?
No, I put it in the front seat in the seat belt. I put it up in the front seat with me. It's sitting in the seat belt.
It's like your newest grandchild.
I can look over and see whether my drones are with me.
Have you
or
named
not.
Your drone yet?
Not yet. Maybe I should have a drone name.
I think
name.
You should have a drone name. It needs a code name, Doc.
That's right. Yeah. I decided not to put my name and address on the drone.
That's probably a great idea.
We got an email from Nathan. Dear Dr. Schertz, I have a 9-year-old son who loves to build things. Now, he just worked on a small project, which he was making a little miniature helicopter. But he'd like to do more stuff. Now he wants to build a robot or remote control vehicle. And he says, I just don't know where to turn. I love these projects, but, I need to, you know, I need to respond to this need that he's got. Well, Nathan, I'll tell you, I've got the perfect solution for you. I just bought one of these, the Lego Mindstorms EV3. I talked about this as, you know, Christmas gift. Yep. I just bought one for my nephews. Their father's an engineer, and they like to do technical stuff. And they love Legos because you can build them. So this thing actually comes with a built-in processor. They call it the Brick. And you can connect it wirelessly, and it's got its own programming language. So you can actually program this thing. It's got sensors, proximity sensors. It's got little cameras. It has things that make sounds. And you can actually program it, and you can do things with it. And you can make robots. You can make it has motors, servos. So you can make robots. You can make little cars. And it is fantastic. It has gotten great, great reviews in schools that want to teach technology. So it does two things. First of all, the kids can assemble it all themselves because it's Legos. You don't need to have any kind of tools.
Right.
And then you learn programming language. You can test it out. And they have some programs that are already programmed. So you can just download the program to the Brick. And it will start functioning, and then you can start modifying it. Now, it's $349, and you can get all sorts of add-on kits if you want to make this or make that. You know, you can probably spend a lot more than that. But I would recommend that you also get the Mindstorms EV3 project book. It's not part of it, but the project book got really great reviews because there are some excellent projects in that are much better than the projects that come with the kit. And the final thing that's quite nice, there's a blog, and there's a community, a Lego Mindstorm community, and then kids start sharing things, what they're building. So I think this could be a great long-term father-son project for you and your son.
Legos are some of the best things ever.
They are.
I think we should get some Legos and build a drone recovery vehicle so we can chase your drone around when it lands in a remote location.
I'm thinking I think I need to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Next thing, I'm going to try to get a basket for my drone so I can deliver things by drone. I'm going to compete with...
Well, this would be great in the summertime. You have a backyard, right?
Yeah.
You have cookouts and stuff. You could deliver hot dogs and things like that around the back. Drinks.
Maybe I could get like some sort of food delivery platform around the... I don't think anybody want to eat at my house, though, because, you get a hamburger and a haircut at the same time.
Oh my, well, this is what you would expect from us here on Tech Talk Radio. Doc, put your headphones back on. You're not finished. We need more emails for next week.
That's why we have a professional here. We need more emails. We love your emails.
Where is the
Send them to techtalk@stratford.edu, and we'll cover them on the air, and we might answer them personally. And of course, check out the Stratford University programs by going to stratford.edu and let them know that you heard about Stratford on Tech Talk.
We are just getting started here. This is Saturday morning Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM, HD2. Stand by. More coming up right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
It's time. Time to put your talents out there on your terms. Get full credit for your ideas and hard work and set your own pay. If you're ready to be your own CEO, Stratford University's life-changing Masters in Entrepreneurial Management program can show you how to develop and launch your business. From writing a solid business plan to financing, legal issues, staffing, even branding and marketing. Let Stratford show you the ropes and walk you over the pitfalls of running your own business. Choose from online or in-classroom courses at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner and Woodbridge. It's time. Time to take charge of your future on your own terms. Contact us today at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. Or give us a call at 800-444-0804. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University, it's time to be more.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge of Stratford University, and now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
guest. Today we're going to talk about John V. Blankenbaker. That just rolls
right off the tongue.
John V. Blankenbaker. Now, John Blankenbaker created Kenback One, the world's first personal computer. He advertised it for $750 in Scientific American in 1970.
Uh-huh.
Kenback One was designed in the 70s, and it predated microprocessors. You see, Intel came out with their chip 44004 chip, the first large-scale integrated circuit, in 1971. So it did not use a CPU, as we are
how
now
big
know.
Was this? You'll probably get into how big it was.
It was not really that large. Uh-huh. It was only about a foot long, about 4 inches high, and about 8 inches deep.
That's not bad.
No, it wasn't very powerful either. It also didn't have much of an input output. Uh-huh. It had switches for input and it had lights for output. It was like one step up from my mechanical computer.
I gotcha.
Now,
I understand.
John Blankenbaker was born in Berkeley County, South Carolina, July 4th, 1933. He received the Bachelor of Science in Physics, which is why I like
another
this guy,
one of your guys,
and Math from Oregon State College in 1952, and a Master of Science in Physics from UCLA, and later on a Master of Science in Electrical Engineering from MIT. Now, John Blankenbaker started designing his first computer device in 1949 when he was just a freshman at OSC. He wanted to calculate logarithms for his weekly physics lab, and he just didn't like to do that manually.
Now, who would?
Yeah, but he gave up. It was so complicated. You see, back then, that without a CPU, he was actually using a flip-flop circuit as a counter, and using accumulators, and actually using what they call small integrated circuits. But back then they were TTL circuits, and they were transistor logic circuits, and to get this thing going, it was a little bit complicated. Mm-hmm. But he stopped working on it, but he never gave up on the idea. In the summer of 1951, John worked for NBS, National Bureau of Standards, on the Standards Eastern Automatic Computer, SEAC, and he learned more about how computers worked. You know, these big computers that they were working on had vacuum tubes. After graduation from OSU in 1952, he worked at Hughes Aircraft and was assigned to the Department on Working on Digital Computers. Kind of, he's sort of in this theme there.
Uh-huh.
This was all before the CPU came along. And at Hughes, he was basically designing a digital computer using a flip-flop circuit that connected to memory, and they would have accumulators to keep track of the various numbers. And he realized that with just a simple flip-flop circuit and with enough memory, he could actually make a very low-cost computer. And that triggered the continuation of the design that he started back in 1949. Now, the business data unit at Hughes was shut down. He lost his job and he went into what they call a short period of consulting.
that's Latin for unemployment.
Yeah, I think he consulted his navel for a short period of time. Then he landed a job and he went back to school then and earned a master's degree from MIT in electrical engineering. Then he got a job at Scanlon Electronics, which was an early pioneer in real-time communications. And he was then trying to bring stock market prices to brokers on a ticker tape, you know.
Mm-hmm.
This is like the beginning of electronics, just getting into Wall Street. Then in 1970, he took his big break, and he founded the Kenback Corporation and designed the small computer. Now, the name Kenback, look at his last name.
I'm thinking this is really doesn't make
Blankenbaker,
any sense.
Blankenbaker. And you take the middle six letters out of it, K-E-N-B-A-K, Blankenbaker, Kenbake. And he liked that because he said, you know, Kenback is sort of like Kodak. And he says Kodak was successful. It started with a K, ended at a K. So he kind of liked it.
You know, sometimes those success stories don't come in twos, do they?
No, it doesn't. So he was planning to have a. See, he made this the first computer design. He called it the Kenback One because he was planning to have a whole series
like
of them,
a thousand of them.
And it was built almost entirely from transistor logic TTLs, which were sort of popular then. And he actually designed this thing. It had a whopping 256 bytes of memory.
Uh-huh.
Not kilobytes, just 256 bytes of memory. And it had an accumulator. And this thing is really, it's on one circuit board. The circuit board is about, looks like about 5 inches by 10 inches. And it's got all these very small electronic circuits that he soldered in. And he sold this unit for $750. Now,
that's not a bad price.
He came out in 1970. In 1971, Intel released the Intel 4004, which was the first microprocessor. I think that was a 4-bit microprocessor that they came out at. They came out shortly thereafter with an 8-bit microprocessor. Of course, that was the beginning of the CPU and the real personal computer game. So the reason he had the first one is that he predated, of course, the CPU.
Yes.
Now, Kenback 1 was a true stored program computer. It had 256 bytes of memory, a wide variety of operations, and it had the equivalent speed of 1 megahertz. Now,
that's not real fast.
Now, a year after he started the company, he sold two of these to a private girls' school because he wanted to teach computer science. See, the idea was you could actually set some switches. And you could, and by setting switches, you could input a computer program and store it in the 256 bytes of memory, and then you could play back through the memory, and then the output of the program would show up on how the lights were lit up. He had 7 lights, so there'd be lights on the output.
Uh-huh.
And so we thought you could really teach fundamentals of computer science using this thing for schools. Now the problem was the teachers in the schools didn't even know what a computer was.
Yeah, it makes it difficult to teach about,
so
it, doesn't it?
He would try to, he went to all these school conferences to sell this great new innovative tool, and the teachers didn't even know what to say. So it turned out not to be a rousing success. He sold 40 machines in the end.
That's more like a failure than a rousing success.
Yeah, and he did write a program for it, the largest program that Blankenbaker ever wrote for the Kenbach, and it took every last byte of memory, all 256 bytes. It was a program that played 3-dimensional tic-tac-toe.
Well, that sounds like fun.
And so you'd play with, and I guess you'd play 3-dimensional tic-tac-toe, and based on the lights, the light pattern, it would tell you what move the computer was going to make.
Uh-huh. So you played against the computer. That's kind of cool.
You played
though.
Against the computer. Now, the problem was the program, just to program the moves, took all the memory. So there wasn't enough memory left over for the computer to know when it won. So even after it won, it just kept playing.
Uh-huh. But why?
Because there wasn't enough memory to add the line I've won, to stop it.
Uh-huh.
Now, so that was a small problem, but that actually, and he said he would play the Kenback one, and it would win about 60% of the time.
It's kind of the computer version of piling on. It just keeps playing after.
That's right. It just keeps going on. Now it lacked critical capabilities such as input output.
Yeah.
I mean, these little switches and lights really weren't that good. Now, he actually had a slot in the front panel where he's going to have a kind of a card reader where you could have more input output, but he never came up with the Kenbach 2.
He was out of business by then, right?
Now he wrote another program that was very successful. You'd have a person tell you a series of, you'd say, give me a series of heads, tails, heads, tails, heads, tails, and it would predict what the next thing you would say, whether it be a head or a tail. And it turned out that people really are not random number generators, and if you give someone 12 random, 12 heads and tails, it's going to more than likely predict what you're going to say next because
it
starts picking up a pattern. And that was really one of the most popular programs that ran on the Kenback 1.
So could you do anything useful with this, like calculate numbers and things of that nature?
Well, no.
It's like a glorified
video game. Was really meant to teach how computers worked. It had all the functions of... It could store a program. It could step through the program. It could store logic. It actually had an input and an output, although they were rudimentary. And so you could actually learn how a computer functioned.
So he was hoping that maybe teachers would buy this thing, take it into the classroom.
It was designed to be a teaching machine.
Except that the teachers didn't know anything about it.
Right.
There's a fundamental problem with his plan here.
That's right. Yeah. Now, in 1973, after selling only 40 machines, Kenbach Corporation closed its doors. And Kenbach 1 was purchased by CT Educational Products and renamed the CTI 5050.
Oh, that's much better.
Yeah. Now, of course, they never really were successful either.
No.
The Computer Museum of Boston judged this to be the first commercially available personal computer. Now, after he got out of building the Kenbach 1, he went and he worked for the International Communication Sciences Corporation on a system to transmit four voices over a 9,600 baud kilobit per second line. Then he worked for Symbolics Corporation to create a Lisp computer. He finally retired in 1985, and now he works with Germana Colonies, a genealogical organization. Now, I did find out that somebody just loved this Kenbach, and they built a kit, the Kenbach 1 Series 2 kit. And you can go to kenbachkit.com, and they're selling that kit for $999.
Okay. Wait a second. So we could have built one, bought one already built for $750. You can now buy the kit to build your own for $999.
Yeah, but that's okay. Like 38 years
I'm
later.
Just being silly. Yeah. Sorry.
So you can go now. The thing is, the guy made. I went to the website. He made 20 templates for the kit, and so mm-hmm. you've got to rush if you want to get one of these.
There's only 20 of these.
He wasn't counting on a big sale here, but it's kind of he loves it.
Have you bought yours yet?
No, I didn't yeah. buy one.
What's wrong with you?
I'm still trying to get my mechanical computer going.
This has got shirts written all over. Yeah, you've got to buy one.
It really does. I think I may have to get it and play with it. There's no doubt about it. So there's John V. Blankenbaker, the man who developed the world's first personal computer.
That's very interesting stuff, and I sure hope you all were paying super big attention out there, because we're going to ask you questions about this later on. And if you have the right answer, and you're the number that I pick out of the hat here, you're going to win a fabulous prize. The number to call, write this down with your number two pencil, 1-877-936-9333. 1-877-936-9333. Don't call us quite yet. We'll let you know very shortly. Tech Talk continues momentarily on Federal News Radio.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Technology is constantly changing. An effective IT manager must not only understand the possibilities and limitations of the technology, but also the requirements and constraints of the business world. Enhance your career today with a master's degree from Stratford University School of Computer Information Systems. Classes are offered day, evening, and weekends to match your busy schedule and are taught by experienced faculty members with industry experience. Earn your master's degree in as little as 15 months with an accelerated program in software engineering, information systems, information assurance, or telecommunications. Learn more about earning your master's degree from Stratford University at stratford.edu or call 1-800-444-0804. Disclose statements available at stratford.edu/disclosures. Stratford University, 1-800-444-0804.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
And now it's time for Washington's most favorite and longest running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. And now here's the host and star of our show. It's not Gene Rayburn. It's not Richard Dawson. It's not Bert Convey. It is not Steve Hyrevey. It is not Dr. Richard Schertz. Please put your hands together for this guy right here.
And I would be that aforementioned guy right here. My name is Jim Ross. I'm the adjunct professor for messing things up and lowering the academic bar at Stratford University, and particularly on Tech Talk. In Profiles in IT, we just spoke about John Blankenbaker, the creator of the world's first PC, the Kenbach 1. If you can tell me how much a Kenbach 1 sold for, you will win tickets for two, fine dining at the Escoffier at Stratford University on the campus in Falls Church, or at Cafe Karim on the campus in Woodbridge. If you're calling from east of Berkeley County, South Carolina, the number is 877-936-9333. If you're calling from west of the campus at Oregon State College, 877-936-9333. And, of course, the wild card line is 877-936-9333. Adjunct professor for prize distribution and crowd control, Andrew Mitchell, is standing by to take your calls. This is the Pop Quiz on Tech Talk Radio. And as we mentioned last week, we have a special event coming up at the Escoffier at Stratford University. Joining us now, Christopher Carey, who is new to Stratford. Christopher, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. First of all, tell us what we're talking about here is the listener dinner for the listeners to Tech Talk. How did this idea evolve?
We decided, along with Jordan Lynchman, who's the director of the program, to be able to obviously highlight some of the culinary students and the menu that we're going to present.
We're going to offer a chance for Stratford listeners to attend this event, but this is something you guys do all the time at Stratford. This is part of the curriculum, is it not?
It is. It evolves, obviously, with the students as they progress through the program. So about every 10 weeks or so, there is events that will take place as the students get to a level of competencies that they're able to then produce a proper meal for outside guests.
Now, these events have been going on at Stratford for a while, and basically you offer lunch and dinner on Thursdays. Is that correct?
Correct. Lunch starting this Thursday, depending on the weather, will be at 11:30, and then dinner starts at 7:30.
This is part of the philosophy at Stratford where students learn by doing, right?
Correct.
And
it gives them the real life experience if they don't have it, if they have not gone on to the externship part of their program. So this gives them a little bit of a live fire type of situation within the university.
Now, if I understand correctly, the semester just started. Your new semester just started at Stratford. So you've got a whole new batch of culinary students. Is that accurate?
Yes, it did. It started yesterday on the 10th.
So how do you start with these kids? I mean, and I'm say kids, but these folks could range anywhere in age, right, in any sort of technical proficiency.
Correct. Most of them, my last set of classes, I had everyone from 18 to 40 in my class. Most of them are about on the same pathway that they want to earn their degree at Stratford and then, use it to advance their careers or begin their careers. I had a student who was doing it, even though he's been working for over 20 years. He wanted to get the actual degree. So he's going on to get his bachelor's in culinary arts. And then we had students who just graduated from high school in the early part of May from the area who are going on to get their associate's degree.
Now, I would suspect that these folks, they vary in age, they vary in expertise, and they probably vary in what they want to do with the learning, the knowledge that they're going to get from the course at Stratford. What do you see? What are these folks trying to do with that knowledge?
Most of them are using it, obviously, to their benefit. They realize that, obviously, having a degree from Stratford and that's obviously accredited through the American Culinary Federation as well as, through the state of Virginia education, that it gives them a bump up, an edge when they go to look for a job now or in the future, that they do have that diploma that's behind them. That they can back it up with a very excellent accredited program.
Now, in terms of the culinary school in particular, are these folks all trying to become a chef, or are there other things they might be trying to do with this?
It's very diverse. The classes that I've had, I have had people who just want to have the degree to be able to advance in their current employment. Others are using it as advancement for their own personal gain, and others are using it to eventually open up their own business, catering businesses, cafes, etc.
So basically, these folks are doing a lot of things with this information and with this program. Walk us through how this works for those who have never been involved in a culinary class. What sort of things are you going to teach these folks?
Sure. Obviously, there are two sides of the school that we teach. I teach mostly the labs, which means that they're actually physically in the kitchens, cutting, chopping, dicing, sautéing, roasting, that type of stuff. And then we have the other side is the actual classroom work. So they take such things as culinary math, where they learn how to price out menus. Sanitation is also included in the lecture classes, so they go over all the stuff that is required by the health department. And then on my side, it's more about the physical. Here it is, a kitchen. This is how you work. This is the equipment. This is how you use the equipment. This is a knife. This is how you're going to use the knife. This is how we break down a chicken from whole. This is what you're looking for in the quality of the ingredients. So it ranges from back to front, so that they get a well-rounded, well-rounded education.
This is something that if folks who are interested in cooking would find this interesting, even if they weren't trying to pursue this as a career, I would suspect.
It is. I actually believe that in several of the other classes, people are using it. You're able to go, I believe, to just take the lab side. You don't have to take both. If you take both, you're heading off more towards your associate's degree than onto the bachelor's degree. So you can come in and just take lab classes to get some experience.
Tell us a little bit about the facilities where the students are doing all of this at Stratford. This is in Falls Church, right?
Correct. We're right on the address is the 7777 Leesburg Pike. It's Falls Church, right on Route 7 at the intersection with 495 in Falls Church. We are it's a five-story building, and we are on the fifth floor. And the equipment is all top-of-the-line commercial, you know, ranges and stoves, et cetera.
Now, do you have anything to do with the program? I know there's a culinary arts program in Woodbridge, and also, of course, Baltimore is specifically a culinary school. Are you involved in that at all?
No, I'm not. I'm focused at this point only on Falls Church. And then we will be opening, I do believe, later in the spring, and then for the full time in the fall, a campus in Alexandria.
So the folks now are just getting their feet wet. They're starting to learn what they're doing. They're chopping, they're roasting. And when they get all of this down pat, then you start serving these meals at Stratford, the lunch and the dinner. What kind of menus do you have these folks prepare?
Sure. We actually just implemented a very new menu that just obviously started yesterday. And what I've done is tried to focus each of the different sections or competencies that they need to do for what we call the entree production class. One is focusing on the poaching, the braising. Another focuses on saute. Another section focuses on grill and deep frying. And the menu evolves around those competencies that they need to pass for the class. So each of the menu items is focused on one or two very specific techniques that are required for their, you know, for their knowledge going into restaurant work or catering work, et cetera.
Now, the folks that are already in this, in the industry, so to speak, that are taking this class, what sort of jobs do they currently hold?
Several of them work within university, like George Washington University, within their culinary or catering department. I've had other people work with some of the larger caterers in the area. One or two are working part-time in restaurants, independent restaurants, and some of the smaller chain restaurants here in the D.C. area. So it's pretty widely based. There's a few that are doing independent stuff where they're just contracting out themselves to persons to be able to do dinners for, you know, weekly. So it's a good group.
So Christopher, let's talk a little bit about you. You are obviously a chef. Tell me about where you've come from and where you studied and where you've been a chef.
Sure, I've been in the Northern Virginia area for the last decade or so, working most of the time in a very high end country inns such as the Goodstone Inn out in Middleburg, the Ashby Inn out in Paris, Virginia. I've opened up the Wine Kitchen in Leesburg. And then previous to the Northern Virginia area, I was in Charlottesville at a Relay and Chateau property called the Clifton Inn. Before that, I spent most of my youth was growing up in New York City. I went to Fordham University, where I graduated with an economics degree, and pursued a career on Wall Street and decided I didn't like sitting behind a desk. So I've always enjoyed cooking. The family has enjoyed cooking. So I got involved with doing schooling at the French Culinary Institute, which is now called the International Culinary Institute, and our International Culinary Center. And then after working for many years in the city with very top-notch restaurants such as Le Cirque and Restaurant Daniel, I went overseas and lived and worked in Paris for just shy of 2 years, where I also went and attended the Cordon Bleu and worked my way through a few of the local bistros as I was able to find some work, and then came back and fell in love with working in country inns and from a summer that I did for a little bit when I was overseas. And then that's how I got to, you know, down to Clifton in Charlottesville. Wanted to be in a country, but close enough to a city that if I needed to have my concrete under the feet, I could get there.
So how did you make the jump from cooking full-time to now basically full-time academia?
Sure. One of the places that I've worked at just recently did a lot of culinary classes. And in the past, we did a lot of culinary boot camps for weekends for the guests. And I've always enjoyed the recreational side of the cooking. And as myself running restaurants, bringing young line cooks up through the ranks, I've always enjoyed the mentoring side. And, you know, decided to make a little bit of a career change and found the job at Stratford.
It can be a grueling lifestyle working in the restaurant industry. I mean, basically, you're working at nights all the time, right?
It is. Ironically, it's been a big transition for my wife and I that I'm home on weekends, so she's still not quite sure what to do with me.
Put you in the kitchen, right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So this is an interesting field, and what advice would you give somebody who is interested in working in culinary arts before they dive into this? What should they be thinking about?
I think one of the big things is that, you know, it is it's definitely a different lifestyle, and you have to really do it from your heart. I have a weird phrase that if a happy cook, happy food, happy customers. Because it really does represent yourself, the institution that you're working for, and you know you do have to put a tremendous amount of effort and sacrifice into the work to be able to feed someone else, and you give up here and there, birthdays, weekends, nights off for other people that you may only see once. So it is definitely a different lifestyle. My advice would be, definitely, as I've talked to some of the students about, to go and work in a restaurant, work in a catering place, work in a different other food institution, see what you like, see whether this is really something that you want to pursue first before you decide to dive in and spend the money to be able to go to culinary school and, you know, figure out, you know, is this really what you want to do, and understand the sacrifices that do go on, you know, for the restaurant business, being, you know, working at nights, weekends, holidays, that type of stuff. And then from there, make a decision whether you want to, you know, go to school to get a degree, or you can just, at this point in time, you could also go and work for a number of good chefs and learn that way as well.
Now, before we get into the specifics of the listener dinner, if anybody's listening to this program right now who is interested in the program at Stratford, how could they get involved? How should they contact you all?
Sure. The best way probably is through the admissions office as well. So it's stratford.edu or www.stratford.edu, and they have all the contact information there, and you can talk to any of the admissions officers about the program. And there's also online very good information as well describing the program, and you know, can give us a call and come by for a visit. So that you can see what we do.
Now, the listener dinner for Tech Talk listeners is coming up on February the 27th, and I believe it's going to start at 7 o'clock with hors d'oeuvres and cocktails, and then
correct.
At 7:30 promptly we will have dinner. And keeping in mind, this is kind of interesting that it's going to be this dinner for the listeners, but this is the class, right? This will be the class that day for this group of individuals.
It is. this is an actual class, so the students will be doing cooking, obviously under the direction of myself and under Chef Lindstrom as well. But it is the class, and the students will be producing the food. They have 2 days to prepare for it, and then the service starts at 6:30, 7 o'clock or so on Thursday. The menu has obviously been designed by myself and through the direction with Chef Lynchman as well, to be able to highlight, you know, the best that the students can possibly do. And this is a very adventurous menu. I've definitely, when I was looking at the class roster and talked with Chef Lynchman about the students, they're definitely being pushed. This is a very high-end menu.
So can you tell us what we're going to have that night?
Sure. There's multiple. What we're doing is it's going to be an a la carte setting. So you'll be able to choose off the menu. Some of the appetizers we're going to have will be, it's an in-house smoked duck breast with oven-roasted tomatoes and herb vinaigrettes. For an appetizer, we have fried oysters with a sweet and sour beet emulsion, which is really, really wonderful. We have a ravioli, which will have spinach and actually a hen egg, just the yolk. So you'll be able to break into the ravioli and create its own sauce. We also have veal sweetbreads that are all braised, and then they are sautéed with wild mushrooms and a thyme veal demi-glace. And then for some of the main courses, we're doing a harissa marinated leg of lamb with ratatouille mashed potatoes. We also will have a grilled skirt steak with a chimichurri sauce. And then the students have a choice to be able to create their own flavored mayonnaise and whatever French fry they would like to do.
Mm-hmm.
We have a trout almondine, and then we're also doing a whole roasted Cornish game hen that will come with the French green beans, some spinach pan sauce.
That is a ton of food. Now, what time will the class start cooking in order to have this ready?
They do. They arrive at 6 o'clock, and dinner starts at 6:30, so they have about a half an hour.
No kidding.
They have Monday and Wednesday to be able to prep for it. So everything as a normal restaurant, you're running it as a normal restaurant, so things are prepped the day before or the morning of. I have a rather large class in the morning, so they will be helping execute the nighttime class as well.
Do you find that there's a certain amount of stage fright that these folks experience when they're getting ready for something like this?
I will be honest. I have to say that I saw a few faces on class yesterday when I was going through the syllabus that most of the class has not had a lot of restaurant experience, more catering. So it's a little bit different. So there's a little bit of stage fright there. But we will guide them so that everything arrives on time and everything will be done well in advance, and so that the panic does not set in.
I love to cook, but I can't say that I'm very good at it. But I'll tell you, if I was under that kind of pressure, I would be flipping out. So tell us again, if any of our listeners, space is limited for this. If any of our listeners want to come to this dinner, how would they do that?
Sure. You just call the university directly and ask for the culinary department. And I do believe on the website that we're going to be putting up within the next week or so, there'll be a link for reservations there, and they'll be monitored so that we don't go too far over the maximum amount that we're going to do to make sure that the students do execute everything correctly for that.
There is indeed a link on the website. If you go to the calendar events, you can get there and then reserve your spot. It's $20 per person. If you have won the pop quiz on Tech Talk, you can use your coupon in order to pay for your dinner that night. Beverages are available, soft drinks for free, and, of course, alcohol, beer and wine and such are available for $5 a drink. Chef Christopher Carey, thank you so much for your time. I look forward to seeing you on February 27th at the Tech Talk Listener Dinner. That's all we have time for this week. See you next week here on Tech Talk Radio on 1500 AM, 820 AM, federalnewsradio.com, and online at techtalkonline.com.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during... WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m. and federalnewsradio.com.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts